and put it squarely in the center realm of Torah learning. That's the point. Whereas Rav Shach should have made a Daf Yomi for the Rambam. Didn't. The Lubavitcher Rebbe did. But then again, the one who made a Daf Yomi wasn't a Misnagid either. A man Shapiro were the worst father King of Blin. He was a chosid.
He was a
square
or good in it.
But
that was
all. He was more a chosid than a Misnagid. See, more activists. So now, do you go ahead? You go ahead and you sit down and teach. This is look.
Is it the Beit Shammai concept?
In a sense, but not entirely. Definitely in a sense. But do you go ahead and you teach college kids who know absolutely nothing of a difference between an aleph and a beis or a pasuk chumash? Do you go ahead and you sit down and teach them Kabbalah?
Are you asking me?
Rav Shach will say lunacy, and Lubavitcher Rebbe will say pnimius, and let's get him going. You know, like microwave Judaism. You know what microwave Judaism is? You start cooking from the inside out. When Rav Shach wants to go into the oven, and you bake from the outside in. Simple as that. Why shouldn't I give a person pnimius as the other approach? And get to that heart and flame the nuclear energy that is there, guaranteed it's there, and let it do its job. As Lubavitcher.
These are two
models. But the comparisons the Rav is bringing from Rambam to Zohar and Kabbalah, this is two different worlds. The only way I could understand Rav Shach, which by the way I happen to know personally, he mediated an argument I had with the Rav Peretz in Magdiel. It was a anyway, the negets kenaf kavod, the verse in Yeshayahu, the tithing guy there, you reach old age, disappears, but kuvet something, you can't overcome it. It's impossible to overcome it. And I think Rav Shach, I think he sees himself as the good Lador, and he's a little bit against the fact that he didn't attack in something that was so successful.
Well, you are telling me something which I'm trying to get you to understand. If instead of looking at the words and looking in between
I thought the Rabbi is telling you because Rambam is so sophisticated. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think Rambam is much more easier to learn than any Gemara.
You see, but I must have. You see, when I look for COVID, you're talking to an expert.
Well, but you're not in the stage where Tava
Kinezer. I'm getting older. And I have more COVID all the time. Hey, whatever I see, there's no question. When a person demands kavod, it has to be done in such a way that if pushed to the wall, he can show you a pasuk or a halacha. Because if he's just going to say it's because I'm getting older and I want kavod, he'll lose his whole power base instantly.
The rabbi knows that people don't demand COVID in such a way. Okay. Some demand COVID by saying ich will nicht COVID. That's how demands COVID.
The entire area of Torah Yiddishkeit is split now into two. Chassidim in the Ger, whatever that is, and Rav Shach in the literature world, the yeshivish world. This is nothing more than a replay of 75 years ago when Agudas Yisrael was founded. Nothing more than a replay. The only slight difference is that in 1907, at the beginning, there was a third element. There was the Lithuanian yeshivas, there were the Hasidische of Poland, and there were the Germans. The Germans don't exist today, they don't count. They're gone. But it's the two power plays that we've had for 70 years. It's the same thing. All right, so could we please come back to Rav Kook once more in another on page 4, number 7. Nothing more than a repetition of the same theme. Pam achat yashav etzel harav echad mechabrei kibbutz smoli yadua. Again, there was a left-wing kibbutznik sitting with the Rav and obviously conversing and bargaining. Over what? Over frumkeit. Toch kidei sicha amal toch haver kibbutz. Ani eneni dati. When Rav Kook challenged him to something, so his only answer, his only rationale was, what do you want from me? I'm not from. Kifaso Arabi Adol, Rav Kook grabbed his hand. lechatza bechoska, holding on to it with incredible strength, v'amar and said to him, ma ata medaber, ata ichad dati? What are you talking about? You are not from. V'achar kama shanim, years passed, is nifkash oto chaver kibbutz im Rav Tzvi Yehuda. That same fellow that Eino Dati met Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, the son, he told him exactly what the conversation was and what the circumstances were, etc. And this time he editorialized to the son, long after Rav Cook was dead. I feel that handshake till today. Till today. It's a mindset, guys. You know, if I'm being trite, if I'm overkilling, it's because I don't have the confidence, and I think I'm right, in a generation to understand this thinking. And therefore I'm nudging you for these going on, 3 years now. It is a different mindset that I want you to get into. Many have entered the world of this thinking, this model of thinking, through Lubavitch, but not everyone is a chosid. So I give you an alternative.
But wait a minute. For some of us, at least, sitting at this table, we don't have a problem with Rav Cook because we come from the other side ourselves. We have the problem. What?
What's that side?
The side that the people who Rav Cook was trying to makarev. We are them.
You mean we are the Ani Lo Dati?
I don't mean you. So everybody else sitting here. So that I can't understand having a problem with Rav Cook. I have a problem with Rav Sonnenfeld and that group.
On Thursday night I'll have to say a shiur in Vayol Moshe and Sakhna Rabbi Kaya. I'm ready tomorrow night. I went through it just as much as I went through Rav Cook. You know why? Because you only know white when you see black. Mm-hmm. You only know one side when you see its opposite. You only can substantiate your thinking to make sure that it's not just a passing infatuation by seeing all of the objective and the objectors.
I mean, if these people are saying, don't makarev, associate with these mechalalei Shabbat, they're talking about me.
That's correct.
Because that's where I come from.
Take you to Satmar right now and they'll tell you? They tell it to a group of 11th grade girls who might teach. They tell it, an 11th grade girl, right before Shavuos, go on what we call a Historia trip. They see in New York City, Breuer's, New Square, Muncie. They go down to Brooklyn, they see Crown Heights and Williamsburg. And they ask these questions of Lubavitch, and they want to know the approach of Lubavitch, and they ask the questions of Satmar.
They ask Satmar themselves.
They ask Satmar, and Satmar tells them openly, our problem with Lubavitch is this union of Karev. Let us be Makar of ourselves. We have work to do on ourselves. That's the way to bring Mashiach. We don't have to go out and worry about all those who are long lost to Torah. That's why you get all of these hybrids all over.
Good. So if such a group speaks this way, and they come to me for funds for their educational institutions, why shouldn't I respond, well, you're taking care of yourselves, so fund yourselves. What do you want from me? Because I want to fund Lubavitch and other organizations that are more outreaching in their perspective. Should I say that to them? I don't.
All right, now that you know, how do you feel about it?
Anybody who comes, I send them away with a check, I send them away with something.
No, how do you
I'm
feel
polite.
About it?
I'm just asking a question.
Okay, but I'm asking you a question also. How do you feel about it? If you resent it, then it's a mitzvah of Lubavitch. 100%. Because if you look at the Rambam, nine-tenths of tzedakah is not the amount. Nine-tenths of tzedakah is the countenance on your face, the smile on your face.
I'll tell you.
But if you don't resent it, then you have reached the madrega of Rav Kook. Because Rav Kook, notwithstanding all of his objectives, as we learned in our last month, okay? notwithstanding all of them, he respected them as human beings. If you can respect the ones who are teichniakis and eating chametz and mm-hmm. Pesach, I shouldn't respect mm-hmm. those who are sitting and learning with Pesach? Now, you don't. Everyone has the right to make his and her choices. And among the choices, to have favorites.
Right, okay.
Okay? Yeah. But you're committed to Habratza Satara? Yes?
To what?
To the propagation of Torah.
Yeah.
Do they learn in Torah in Williamsburg?
Yeah.
That's cookie and thought.
But also what you're saying, I think, this kind of thinking is deeper than that, because, I mean, the first time I remember I heard this actually wasn't from a cook, I think actually it was from Rabbi Feedback. And I realized that I say about people, so-and-so, he's not religious. You know, people do this, you know. I think it's very hard to think, not to think in those categories of, other, you know, the religious people and the non-religious people. It's also, there's not, you know.
Well, you got to know whose house you can eat in.
That's a different question.
Right. Would God cook be careful where he's eating? I mean, he'll know that he's in a house where he can't eat.
But that's
he's not in an ivory tower.
But
I think he dissociates observance from being so dati.
Yeah, but that's a different
answer to that question. What would God cook though?
I don't know. You figure it out. You guys know just as well as I do. I want to tell you something. Wait a minute. I suspect that there is a bigger expert than me, Rav Kook, sitting here in Joel.
Not me.
The man learned with Rav Tzvi Yehuda, what, 3 years?
Yeah.
I didn't.
Yeah.
He did, man. Yeah. I don't think we ever mentioned this here. It's been a quiet secret. Here is a man, a rock hewn from the original. Ask him. Did you ever speak to the Rosh Hashanah on these things?
I never asked him personally. I mean, I was there in yeshiva, but I think he would have. But I've also heard other. I mean, I don't think this approach is limited to him. I mean, I also heard Mir. I mean, somebody told me Mir that he went down, that there was a can of tomato sauce that they had a big question about. They saw in the garbage. He went down and he asked the guy, he said, "Did you use this tomato sauce?" The guy said, "Of course not. I wouldn't use fresh tomato sauce." He sat there and he never ate in the dining room. Sit down and had a bowl of spaghetti with the tomato sauce. Because he said, you know, Eid Echad, Nemon Bishurim, the guy testified, I asked him, that was it, that was the halacha, that's Gemara. You know, I mean, that's halacha, not the halacha of, oh, you know, maybe the person's, you know, we have to worry about the person's not religious. I mean, you find something sort of about like the joke about Lakewood, that the people, you know, that the bachman there won't eat from the heter or the Rosh Hashiva. You know? When you say, you know, you're not eating the guy's house, you know, what things can you believe him about, what things can't you believe him about? It's not a question of whether he's religious, it's a question about this particular thing. It's a different perspective. I think it's a different perspective.
Jerry.
I think it's hard to have a perspective.
You have a family member, okay, who was very close and thought to Rav Sandberg. When he got finished Shabbos here, I didn't know whether I would eat in his house.
Not because of Kashrus.
It's
because
very liberal.
Oh,
yeah.
It's a pleasure.
What
the hell?
Yeah.
What,
next time
we're here? No. This is a pleasure.
If you would have lived. Yeah. No. Yeah, you sit down and learn the law.
It's in the 50s.
That's when I said to Japan.
How would it explain? The Sharabi, Saratsabi, the Hanani, Levi, Cohen, all the families that came from Teman, from Yemen. And systematically, I didn't know what systematically means until about a year and a half ago, but systematically, by an enforced policy, took off the pies, put them in a machine, a re-grinded machine, and made a new image of them. How would Rav Kook have seen that?
He would have fought it tooth mm-hmm. and nail. He would have gone to his grave over it. The way he fought everything else. The man was a fighter. There's only one difference between him fighting and others fighting. He never gave up. There's no such thing as giving up.
And Rav Sonnenfeld gave up?
Rav Sonnenfeld realized there is, when you have to have energy conservation. We are losing. We are losing 80%, we're losing 90%.
So why fight here? Let me put the energy in.
Let me put my energies into quality, and from this quality we'll grow and we'll grow and we'll grow.
And this
which is certainly a tenable philosophy. It makes sense. It mamash makes sense. Rav Kook believed that nothing is given up on. You give, everything can be recycled. You gave the dimion of, you know, recycling a personality. Rav Kook believed the same thing. The only thing is the way he worked the machines.
I mean, Rav
Kook's one worked it forward, the other one worked it reverse.
I think it's much harder for us to grasp.
Immensely more difficult. It is so much easier to mach Shabbos Chazir. You just have to worry about a trolt and a kugel on Shabbos, and you'll have a bunch of talmidim around the table and chassidim around in a base medrash, and that's it, and you keep on going. And the Rashi is the Rashi, and the Yerachayim is the Yerachayim, and finish.
Kishim shemitzvah lochiyach, kach mitzvah, tese mitzvah.
Very good.
Now maybe Chaim Zonnefeld saw that we are at a level Sitnishtelfen. And he finally reached that conclusion. The difference between me and Rav Kook said, Nein, ich noch probieren. But eventually we see who was right.
And I say it's different.
Who was right?
No. I'll say it's different. I will say that Kolzman, Rav Kook, I'm trying to talk to Rav Kook. Kolzman, as long as he realized that he can hold not only contact with them, those who are trying to jettison the frum world and throw it off into the ocean, but not to tell them, hey, I, the Rav, hold you to be a Yehudi HaKadosh. You are the holiest thing that I know.
So who's helped us?
Who's helped us?
So
you remember
that
time. That's what I'm saying. Wasn't he influenced this way? He was one of those left wingers, and Begin the same way took off the payas. You have hundreds of examples of individuals who still had a sense of integrity. Don't call me dirt.
What Jerry, I think, is also trying to tell me is I think Rav Kook's is harder to understand, is crazier and less logical. But it's like, I think what Jerry, I think, is saying is that we're here to tell you that what Rav Kook's saying must be true. You understand what I'm trying to say?
What is it that Rav Kook says? I don't know. He says, try, don't give up.
That's right.
In Rav Chaim Zonnefeld says, like the Rabbi explained him, he says, let's stop with this energy throwing into the negativity, which is not going to help. And unfortunately, history proves it's true.
So that's what Jerry's saying. We're here to tell you that history is proving it's not true. So.
Rav Sonnenfeld would never have spoken to me, but I published Mitzvah Sashalom, the second edition.
I know what you published, Mitzvah Sashalom, but
I'm making a point.
I learned in television.
That one person
can do it.
Out of nothing.
Yeah.
What's the phrase? May Ayin.
May Nevozri?
No, Yesh May Ayin.
Yesh May Ayin, no?
That's what happened here, and that's what happened there.
I'm not grasping something.
You're not, but I'm sorry.
We're talking now about Israel and Tzionim, it's specific. That's why I'm here.
No, but we're talking more than about that. We're talking more than about that.
It's a process. It's a whole process.
What about Kook?
So he wasn't only Zionist. He wasn't only interested in Zionism. He was interested in a process of rebuilding the laws.
Do I have to get personal? I get personal. I can get personal. I'm not ashamed.
As long as you don't offend me.
When I was around Bar Mitzvah age, I had a choice. I was 11, 12, 13, even 14, 15. I don't know where. It never changed. I get up in the morning, and I could play tennis on Saturdays and Sundays because I couldn't play during the week. So when I get up Saturday morning, I says, well, what should I do this morning? Should I go to shul or should I go play tennis? And I would make up my mind on the spot. I don't know what would tell me to do one or the other, maybe the weather. So if I'm going to play tennis, I take my bike and walk right around the back, and I don't go down Muriel Avenue because the rabbi lives there, but I go down Washington Avenue and up Kenridge Avenue to the tennis court. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that was my state of mind. And yet, I sang after Bar Mitzvah in Shul, I sang Shiah Shirim. I heard it once. I was enchanted by the melody. Sat down, learned it, and read it the next year. In college, I'm telling you, I was ready to marry a shiksa. She didn't like me.
So who was lucky over here?
Who knows? So that's where I was at then. Nothing counted. Mm-hmm. I chucked
I'm not ready. I chucked the whole thing because it Judaism was dead. It was outdated. It was meaningless. It never had any relevance to my life,
so could you
and it was finished.
Yeah.
So now I somehow, in the course of time, 10 or that would be at least 10
years,
maybe 20 years after. No, 10 years after college.
No, we're married 15 years.
No, but 10 years after college. So I had the good fortune of meeting my wife and my father-in-law, and with the help of the Ribbono Shel'olam, we built a Bayit Ne'eman b'Yisrael.
Yeah, well, Jerry,
that's may.
Yesh
may
I.
You also checked the dishes before you
met me. All right, but
so what does it associate with?
Oh, so
if I tell this guy, wait a minute. If I tell this guy at age 13 that you're a Chotei Poshei, you're a Machal Shabbos B'Farasya, okay? And don't impress me with your shtick that you went around on Washington Avenue there because the rabbi lived on Muriel Avenue there, because you know damn well the only reason that you did that is because you didn't want to be scorned at or scoffed at by the rabbi because your father was president over there. So you really didn't want to put yourself, you didn't want to, and you know that, I'm not joking with you, I'm looking you straight in the eyes, okay? So don't tell me that, you know, he was making you into a tzaddik, a Yiddish neshama already, okay? Now, the point is very simple. If on that Muriel Avenue there was a Satmar Shtibel, would they even take notice of him? But if there was a Lubavitch, a Chabad house, at age 13 they would have had him hook, line, and sinker. There was neither. There was neither, so he had to flounder a little while for a little angel sent from the Ravona Shalom to kind of turn him on.
An extra 20 years.
Understand what I'm saying?
This is
a basic approach that he was Mechadish. He is the innovator of this approach, especially as innovator. Again, I say to you, it was the Baal Shem Tov. It was Lubavitch. I mean, this is the issue. This is the basic machlokas. What we are seeing here is the essence of 200 years of history. The essence of history distilled. Chassidim went one way, Chassidim went another way, and Chassidim only of certain branches maintain this course. Lubavitcheva, Lubavitch of today, and so on. Okay? Now, bring it back, please, to page 4, number 9, which is one of the most famous statements, Legabe Vinyan Eretz Yisrael, where we started out. Pamachat, there was one time, Kshiyashav HaRav Imeko HaRav, he was sitting around, the Rav was sitting around with his close inner circle, Nazba Sicha. So the conversation turned al bonei haaretz achilonim, to those who are building Eretz Yisrael who are totally secular. Now the word secular to him didn't exist in essence, but since it existed to others, he had to use it. Zamar HaRav, so the Rav Kook, whose memory was absolutely photographic, Yishanim u'bihilchas binyan beis ha-bechira, we learned in the Gemara in Maseches Me'ila, and this is a quote from the Gemara, bonin b'chol. You build b'chol with things which are not kadosh, and you build the Beis Hamikdash. Yachalkach, and then after it is totally built, is makdishim. Then you make it kadosh, like Moshe Rabbeinu did with the Mishkan. He built, and then he went with the Shem and the Mishkan, and he made it kadosh.
Yes, something like kadosh in Beit Hamikdash.
That's all. Af binyana shel arseinu hakadosha, he said. So too, like the Gemara says, building our Arzeinu HaKedosha is Naseh Kait Bechol Bechelko. Right now we're doing it with so-called Chol, with so-called secular personality, secular means, and not the way that I would do it if I had my choice. Ach Sofo Sheit Kadesh. The end result is going to be Kadosh. V'Harav Itnaseh Mimkomo, after he said this, he so impressed himself with what he had said, is Yatzah B'machol B'shirah Nilava. He got up and he started to sing and dance. Bonim B'chol V'achal Kach Magdishin. Bonim B'chol V'achal Kach Magdishin. Bonim B'chol V'achal Kach Magdishin. He was so, he convinced himself so of the truth of himself, that this was the way that he got up and he started to sing and dance.
I remember this one.
It's incredible. This is the issue.
Is that a song?
No, it's four words from the Gemara. That's the whole point. Now, needless to say, quoting the Gemara, he used it within its context. But the same way that Rav Kook held that there is no such thing as a Jew who can call himself Eino Dati, I'm not religious. There is no such thing to Rav Kook as whole. If we believe Bereshis Bara Elokim Es HaShemayim Es HaOretz, right? Not around the table we believe it here, then there is nothing that's whole. Simple as that. Everything emanates from that one Bria, that one Yesh Me'ayim. Finish. How you use it? No. How you use it? So there are those who use the Sefer Torah for the most dastardly reasons.
Those first few days were whole. It became kodosh on the seventh day.
Very good. So I'm in the eighth day. What do you want from me? Okay? I'm in the eighth day. But then again, but Kabbalah will say you're wrong.
Yeah.
Those 7 days from the minute, from the first Bereshis Bara Elokim, from the first of the Asara Ma'amoros, which is Bereshis Bara Elokim Es HaShemayim Es HaOretz, and the second one is Yihyor. That from the utter inception, this was nothing more than a manifestation of the desire of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If that's the case, where is their chol? Where is their chol? What's there to talk about? So it's not so poshut. You know, it's very nice. I collected these so-called, myself, these so-called anecdotes. My point is that if I wanted to sit here and learn anecdotes with you, it would probably be an insult to your intelligence. Surely a double insult to even record it on tape, which to let others hear it, even if you'll stand for the nonsense. My point is something much more profound. It is that you've got to understand how a human being adopts a philosophy of life that resents Hashem Husham, where we are today. No choice about it. And I believe that it is probably the only thing that's going to pull us out of our doldrums. I still give to those Hebrew from Williamsburg who come around and bother me just as much as they bother you. Unless I know that he's a phony to begin with. That is certainly not my way. My children or my grandchildren will not learn that. Nonetheless, it's a way. So you disagree with me. What can I do? But more than you disagree with me, the important part is for me to be able to internalize all of this and ingest it in such a way that it becomes part of the very substance, the very fabric and the matrix of our personality. It's much harder this way. But you go much further.
When Rav Kook lived, was he alone in this perspective?
No.
Can you name other significant personalities?
Here is an issue, and within the context of tonight, I don't know that we can do it, but listen to me carefully. The Torah world today, whatever that means, the very yeshiva world that I come from, the very black hat world that I represent, at least on Shabbos, wants the rest of the world to believe that all the Gedolim disagreed with it. Now, I started in our last session with the Gera Rebbe, the Chofetz Chaim. They will even quote the Chofetz Chaim's Talmud, as we did Shavuos night, Rabbi Chonam Wasserman, whom I showed you, Erev Shavuos, a reprinted letter in Der Yid, Erev Shavuos of this year, where Rabbi Chonam Zatzal spit at Rav Kook and the Zionist philosophy. However, on the page before, not in Der Yid, but what I showed you last time, what the Chofetz Chaim held of Rav Kook. So I have a choice now. The Talmud, Rabbi Chonam, or the Rebbe, the Chofetz Chaim. There's a machlokas between Talmud and Rebbe. Let's assume there is, for a moment. Whom would I prefer? On the one hand, you say, well, the Rebbe is greater. On the other hand, you say, well, Hilchos Kippas Ro'ah, you always go by the later one. You always go by the later one. Maybe after the Chofetz Chaim died, so Rav Kook went down the tubes. He sold out to Zionism.
So is this Rav Elchanan in his maturity?
Oh, yes.
Right, so now, in his maturity, how does the Talmud stack up against the teacher, against the Rav?
What's it to talk about? Chofetz Chaim held from him immeasurably. Rav Elchanan was one of his finest Talmudim. Okay? But at the same time, the Chofetz Chaim held of Rav Kook, the likes of which you'll have to take the tape of last session and listen to it again. Okay? Now, so there are those in the yeshiva world who will quote Rav Elchanan, as Satmar did in David Erev Shavuos, but they're only telling you half a story. The other half of the story, the Chofetz Chaim side, they don't want to know from. Mm-hmm. And they will say that all the Gedolim were anti-Zionists. What if I present you with an entire book to indicate to you that there is no such thing as all the Gedolim were anti-Zionists? When they were talking about Zionist leaders who had French Catholic wives, they were anti that Zionist leader talking for Jews. Well, I got news for you. Ezra HaSofer was also against that. And he did something. But when they were talking about Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the ultimate, in other words, the mitzvah aspect of it, Chofetz Chaim told his son should go buy land. Who do you buy land through? Through those filthy Zionists who negotiated with the Turks. This is the issue. I said the Turks, by now it was the English, after the Balfour Declaration. You've got to see the position in the perspective of time in the three dimensions of who, what, where, when, and why. Now, are there Gedolim who held? I gave you a list. Rav Moshe Eliasberg, as big as a Chofetz Chaim any day. Rav Tzvi Eshkalisha, a Talmud of none other than Rabbi Akiva Eiger, and his Rebbe Rabbi Akiva Eiger held from him. The Netziv was as great as the Chofetz Chaim and greater. The Netziv is Mr. Rosh Yeshiva number one. The direct inheritor of Vilna Gaon's Torah in Voloshin. Oh yeah, but they'll only quote for you and tell you that his brother-in-law, the Netziv's brother-in-law, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, was so-called anti-Zionist. Well, wonderful. But what about the Netziv? That's where it was all started. That's where Rav Kook learned it from. Don't tell me, just because you sit and you learn Rav Chaim, and you know, I come from Soloveitchik stock, I'm not going to deprecate anything that Brisket Torah does. Just because Rav Chaim was against it, for whatever reason that he had. That means all the Gedolim were against it? The Netziv is less of a Gedol than Rav Chaim? They weren't. And hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of other names. Simple as that. And what's more, everything changed from day to day. You take a look at what was said before the Balfour Declaration and after the Balfour Declaration. Before Petach Tikva was founded and after Petach Tikva was founded. When Petach Tikva was founded, that's when the Chofetz Chaim... Okay, it was founded by ultimately Jews who were from at the beginning, but later on you know what came to Petach Tikva, the riffraff. But when Petach Tikva was founded, that's when the Chofetz Chaim started to learn Hilchos Beis HaBechira. That's when he founded a kolo kochim, that Kohanim should start to learn the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash, because he believed the Aschal of the Gula was there. That they don't tell you, which is a little demeaning intellectually, because I believe a Torah world has got to tell you the facts. When we write a tshuva, we write both sides, and then we arrive at our conclusion.
Well, one of the 48 ways of learning Torah is you're supposed to always quote. You always be honest, right?
No, we're talking about quoting both sides.
Okay.
No, but I'm saying that's the whole idea of learning Torah.
Of being quoting, having
all the facts in front of you. That's the true way to learn Torah.
You take a look at Rav Moshe's tshuvas. He will, before he paskins, he'll tell you, this is the side and here is the analysis. This is the other side and here is the analysis. And I paskin like B, not A. No, if you paskin like B, why do you have to go through the whole thing? to indicate that I understand the other side. I acknowledge that there is another way, but you've asked me the question, I will decide. Don't tell me there's only one way. Don't ever tell me that. I get a little disappointed. Disappointed is not the word. Hot under the collar may be a little more, you know, expressive of the fact. Is that I get hot under the collar because I value every Ben Torah as being intellectually and scholastically superior. And intellectual superiority demands intellectual honesty. It is arrogance to hide what you don't think you want me to believe from me, and by doing so you believe that you will lead me to the truth. Emes is a dialectic, a polar dialectic of fighting. Yes, Vahe Vesufa, you and I are going to fight and kill ourselves as enemies. And we'll walk away after we have honed the blade of truth and sharpened it of every single pigima, of every single little nick, then we'll walk away with the truth. You may walk one way, I'll walk away the other way. It isn't diametrically opposed. It's like two rails on a railroad.
Pat Blakey mentioned the Halakha Bein Morim Kane. I think that was one of the examples he gave.
I hear what you say. I hear what you say, Halakha Bein Morim Kane. That too is part of the Halakha. But let me know it. Let me know it. Don't lead me down the road of false canons of thought. Now, the yeshiva world is doing that. It's a political move. And it's not Torah.
The attitude itself has to hurt the quality of the Torah, doesn't it?
Not necessarily.
No?
Not necessarily.
It seems to me it does, because they have to...
ultimately it has.
They have to can't balance things anymore.
Oh, in its ultimate form, when someone grabs onto it, Torah does suffer.
But
you know, on a short range level.
And you're in the habit of selecting those you want to say and ignoring the other side of an Indian. Ultimately, something is going to suffer. In the long range, you may be right.
Go ahead.
No, I guess I was going to ask whether you don't think that it really affected even the short range. I was going to say, even I think that my experience is actually the opposite. My little experience talking to people is, it seems to me that kind of blindness affects the learning.
I'll tell you. There are people, bless you, there are people who are incapable
for you
of broad-based alternatives. Okay? Education calls it creativity. They need a beaten path. This is it. Do it. I guarantee you Olam Haba, which probably they'll get. And don't deviate from that path. My students call it spit back. Whatever you tell me to do, I'll give it back to you. Simple as that. Originally, I used to loathe spit back. But I see it has a place. There are those who just cannot handle it. You know, I look for its psychological ramifications. A person who's creative is capable of gambling, is capable of saying, I may have made a mistake, is capable of getting back on the path once again. And those who cannot take that path, they are fearful of making a mistake. There are reasons, there are psychological reasons for it. They are obsessed with always being right. They are compelled to be perfect. And you are telling me that if I do this, I will reach perfection. I want Olam Haba. Fine. Young people in the main think this way. But they start reaching 40, 50, and they change. You see. However, if we wouldn't give them this beaten path, you know, this blinder, the horse with the blinders, they'd have absolutely nothing. Or their fuses would blow. They'd be totally confused. Am I advocating it as a shita? No. Is it a necessary evil? No, also. Is it necessary? The answer is yes. No question about it. If I had to give you a very weak kind of analogy, am I advocating anyone going on methadone? The answer is no. I'd rather have no drug addicts whatsoever. But if there is a drug addict who cannot cope with the pains of life, that should there be methadone? The answer is yes, if it works.
But I also, are you, but also from what I, but you didn't start out talking about an individual. You started talking about, you started out talking about the yeshiva world. I mean, started out, but you're talking about the yeshiva world. I mean, you're saying
any world is a conglomerate of individuals.
Yeah, but you can't talk about, but you can't talk about a kind of like, you know, a social. I mean, you're saying just like a person has that kind of blindness or need, you can have a group that can have that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can.
Yeah.
But the creative process in the first step of education, because I've spent some time studying this, the first step is imitation. So what you're saying is
that's valid. Education.
There are people who never get beyond that first step.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's very characteristic of a very young people.
But no doubt that in its final form, very pediatric. Everything a child learns in the first five most critical years of its life is imitative.
Mm.
How you process that imitative skill
you remember in steps.
Is a different story.
That's something
else. Much easier, much easier not to think about this so-called Kukian approach. Mm-hmm. Much easier.
I can see.
But what can I tell you? This is, this is the world that I live in, and it is unquestionably in a world that I have shared since I have learned of Rav Kook. It is the world of Rav Huttner, Zatzal, of Chaim Berlin.
Yes,
he was one of his talmidim. Rav Huttner, Rav Kook, one of Rav Kook's talmidim.
Chaim Berlin at one time was known as a very enlightened type place.
Yeah, and NCSY of this generation, although it didn't start with Rabbi Pinchas Stolper of Chaim Berlin, but he was its major force, and when he came, shortly after he came, I became his associate. I shared that world in no two ways about it.
Seems to me that the attitude that Rav Kook presented is an attitude that is possible in America today, because we're not a land of extremes. We really are not. It may seem like a funny statement
to say that because you live in New York,
but let's
take a trip to Missouri, you and me.
Oh, but that's a different. I'm talking where there are Jews, there are major Jewish population centers, or the more like California,
so
the areas of the country.
Williamsburg isn't an extreme. What are you talking about?
No, you have a right to be as extreme as you want without infringing upon anyone else. In America, you can be whatever you want to be. Someone goes riding down the streets on Shabbos, that's his business. Nobody gets bent out of shape and thinks the whole country's falling apart because somebody's doing something different from you necessarily. But in Eretz Yisrael, I don't think that's possible. I think he was way ahead of his time, and if he were here, he would have been makar of the whole Jewish community, probably. But in Eretz Yisrael, I think everybody's so verbrennt.
Is that true?
Yeah. So that's not such a possible task. In America, you do what you want to do. You want to be from. You don't want to be from. You don't want to be Jewish. Do whatever you want to do.
See, those are verbrennt. It's actually a very small percentage, but they make a lot of waves. Yeah. We think there are a lot. The majority of Israelis are very, very indifferent. All they care about is what kind of car he drives, what kind of refrigerator he has. But those were extremely make a lot of noise. Like over here, such a small minority of Jews. And I know it could make a lot of waves. Mm-hmm. Because a loud minority is much more powerful than a silent majority.
Sure.
And so.
But the point is, yeah, I mean, they're all extremists. But the point is, they're allowed to
do
whatever they want to be.
You're saying that we live in diversity, and up until now, we've survived and flourished with it.
Which, you know, it may not be possible over there because it's a Jewish country, and you know, the whole environment is a little different. Israel.
Is that a Jewish country?
It's a country of Jews.
What command? If a member in the parliament says, "Chukitecha mitzvotecha shmor olam v'et," he's possible. That's a Jewish country. Come on, let's make it the way it is. What's got to do with Judaism? Yeah, of course, you don't
correspond
what's going on over here.
No, and if you and if you put on a tzitzis on your talis katan, you would be holier and holier. So you can't go on that to what the law says.
Why not?
That's
how
the law.
How could the law supersede in, well, you just have a Jewish state.
Low add on and below
you level of the Torah.
You shouldn't add on, you shouldn't take
it away. We're talking about the law of the Knesset.
That's
is
right.
Is the law of the Knesset more important than the law of the Torah?
As long as it doesn't supersede the law of the Torah.
That's exactly what Meir Kahana said. As long as it's not going to go against the law of the Torah.
Meir Kahana just
goes against,
it's
something all right with me. In fact, they kicked him out.
He didn't have to go over and say that. He's a hafiz.
That means the Rav Polish and all other tzaddikim who sit there are simply saying to the Baal Shalom, look, your law is up to here. For me, Ron, that's the law of the Knesset.
Chaim, I hear what you're saying. Okay? It's tough, and it's rough, and it's bitter. There's only one problem.
That's not a solution.
Well, hold on. There's only one problem that I have. And I admit that it's a problem. The cornea of my eye, both eyes, happens to be clouded by irrelevant facts. Such as, in this satanic medina,
which is
called Eretz Yisrael of today, there are more Jews sitting and learning than learned in all of the yeshivas that were destroyed by Hitler, Yimach Shemo, in the entire of Europe, numbers-wise. My eyes are clouded by the fact that the biggest supporter of yeshivas, dollar-wise, in building the pipes into the yeshivas and the sewer pipes out of the yeshivas, the roads to the yeshivas, and the subsidies, no doubt, political machinations, the biggest supporter of Torah, dollar-wise, in the world, are those filthy Zionist pigs. Those whores who give a pittance of the national budget to yeshivas and who rip them off for millions of dollars a year. They are still the biggest supporters, dollar-wise, of yeshivas. My mind is completely distorted, out of whack, by the fact that there are more sforim that have been published in the last 38 years since the state that has been government-funded in one way or another than all the sforim that were printed in Europe in the 1,000 years that we were there. What the heck can I do? I am only interested in one thing. Jews sitting and learning Torah and sforim being printed. That's all I care about. Ask my wife.
Yes.
She'll tell you.
I read what the rabbi said. But the essence of yeshiva is the same product of yeshiva. I learned in yeshiva in Mir, I learned in the Sirsev, I learned in yeshiva at Chadera. The essence is not to sit in a yeshiva and catch in a bank. That's not the essence of it. The essence is to be a creative Yiddish mensch. Unfortunately, the way the rabbi describes it, it sounds like a stream of kosher bukhin living the yeshiva. Unfortunately, it's not like that.
No, I'm not.
Wait,
if
the rabbi
intimate that. I'm only interested when I walk in. I want to see how many are open tomorrow. Simple as that. How many kids are there who are learning Torah? That's all.
That's all I'm interested in.
First of all, it became a movement in Israel. I don't mean the Chiva movement, especially the Koilel movement, which is a very unfortunate.